All right, good morning, everybody. How are you today?
Great.
Good? Hope you all had a good night's sleep, albeit an hour shorter than we all hoped we would get. And have had some time to... Who needs sleep, right?
We'll see who shows up at 10:15 today.
Yeah. kind of like an extra benefit of the fact that we had breakfast 45 minutes early. If anybody comes in at 9:30, it's like, yeah, they're here just on time. So there was a lot of information that we kind of threw at you yesterday, and hopefully you were able to process some of it, and maybe you have some questions about it now, and that's what this session's really about. It's an opportunity to ask any questions you have about anything you heard about yesterday. We got several responses on the form, and we'll go to those, but of course, if anything comes up just in conversation now, we're gonna keep running notes, and we wanna just try and get everybody to a place of comfort by the end of today's.
In particular, to organize any requests for general topics or specific questions, and we'll prioritize based on that and what was submitted online and some things we've heard last night. Anything at all? Anything at all? There's curricular things, technological things.
Well, we can start out with one of my favorite questions from the forum.
Okay.
What's the catch?
What's the catch? Oh.
What's the catch?
Hmm.
So there's no catch. There really isn't. Is the answer that you're all expecting, but is also the true answer. There really is no catch here. Like, we're not requiring you to use the curriculum. We don't require you to do it exactly the way that we recommend you do it. If there was a catch, it would be we'd like to know how your students are doing if you're using the curriculum, because if we're providing a curriculum that is not working, we want to be able to fix it so that it can work. But we're not really trying to push an agenda here. We just want to create an experience that we've seen work for many students here and has been transformative in our own department.
And for us, this has been an opportunity timing-wise. Like, the AP Principles curriculum has been under development now for 5-6 plus years, and it's finally coming to fruition. And wonderfully, all of the materials have now had a history of being open courseware, so to speak, since 2007. And as a couple of us were discussing last night, we've had a tradition since then of making many student-facing materials available. But it wasn't really until AP CSP was coming to fruition that it occurred to us that what we've never really focused on is the teacher side and actually explaining some of the things that we do and trying to provide a look behind the curtain and providing actual textual and electronic resources for teachers in particular. So for us, participating in the CSP initiative with some of our friends elsewhere is really just a manifestation of that. So indeed, no catch.
Can I answer that?
Of course.
Uh-oh, there's a catch.
I get that part, right? We're all laughing and it's funny, kind of not. Yeah. But there's, because there's a long legacy of Microsoft in education, so why in the world would Microsoft, support and amplify the work of the CS50 team and David in particular? And so I get everything from educators hanging up the phone when I go to call them about their application to the workshop. I can't start out by saying, "This is Nacho from Microsoft." Click, they'll hang up. I have to say, "I'm calling on behalf of the Harvard CS50 team to let you know we received your application. My name is Nacho. I'm on the Microsoft side of things." And then yeah. People will hang, right?
So we're supporting.
Oh. Yeah.
And what's that?
What you said. Oh.
So I do get that question a lot. What's the catch for Microsoft? So really, we have a new CEO, Satya Nadella. He's been with us for 2 years, and he has given us a very, very clear directive, and that is to improve everybody's life on the planet, to make everybody more productive and better at everything they do, including educators. And in the case of Microsoft, we have these capillaries all across the globe, where we have boots on the ground and we have employees who are helping people do wonderful things. And when it comes to computer science education, we have a choice. We can either spin something up using proprietary tools and proprietary curriculum, and we can go into that space, or we can look around and we can see who really is doing the most excellent work and then support those efforts. So that's really what led us to Professor Malin and the CS50 team. And we took a look at not just the curriculum and what was happening at Harvard and now at Yale. We looked at that blueprint for the world, and that's how we talk about CS50 at the company. We look at a learning community. So really what David's accomplished is he's figured out how to build a true learning community globally online. And that's something that's empowering not just for computer science educators, but for educators of any discipline. And that's what's so exciting for Microsoft. So we win by, by getting to support his efforts. We're going to get this curriculum out, not overnight, but we will get it out globally to every corner of the earth and empower educators and empower students to do this. We love CS50 because every single language that's taught in CS50 is something that we use every day at Microsoft. So Windows was built on C. And so it's, you know, a fabulous match, and we believe in everything that you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you.
I stepped this close only because that mic's not working, and I needed you to get picked up by my mic. So.
Oh,
I was trying to stare you down here.
We love this guy. It doesn't get any better. You know, I get to work with these educators, and we get to, you know, where the stories are coming, you know, are starting to crop up, and they're coming from across the globe. And so really, that's what we can do, is we can just apply. You're already, everything is excellent. What we can do is say, hey, let's resource you to take it everywhere. Mm.
Thank you. Other questions? Yeah.
I had two questions. One is just like a simple one about grading. I think Nacho said something about you offer this class as pass-fail. Like you're the first one that could do that?
We do at the college. This is a philosophical thing for me. I would just as soon do away with all grades in CS50 and really focus on the notion of pass-fail, albeit with a slightly higher bar. So yes, at the college, we allow students begrudgingly to take it for a letter grade still, as is the culture, but also sat-unsat, satisfactory, unsatisfactory. The only difference for which at Harvard semantically is pass-fail's cutoff is a D-minus and sat-unsat is C-minus or higher for satisfactory work, which feels a little more compelling than getting a D-minus and calling it a pass. And this has been a philosophical change a few years ago for us. In fact, the course for many years was offered pass-fail at Harvard, this very low bar, and at least here in a bunch of places, there's just not much of a culture among this campus, among these types of students, of sort of be willingly taking courses pass-fail, even though there's still a huge proportion of students on campus for whom there is this fear factor of taking computer science and a lot of STEM fields, especially if they have no prior background in it. And so one of the messages we wanted to send along the lines of accessibility some years ago was you should absolutely not fear failure, even if in your own mind failure is a B or worse, but rather you should feel quite comfortable, especially at college when you're finally exiting high school and you've had a fairly structured schedule for some 18 years of your life to explore unfamiliar waters. And so for us, encouraging students to take the course pass-fail or some equivalent has been actually a huge message for us. And it's gone up from 2 to 3% years ago to 13% in more recent years.
Another great question just came in. That wasn't it, though.
Perfect timing.
What are people doing to teach, encourage, and require pseudocoding?
So at the beginning of the year when we started, the kids, you know, we did the lessons on pseudocode.
I'm also coming over
to peanut butter and jelly. the type of thing, the Mike Smith and the phone book. But the kids kind of didn't really see the purpose originally of pseudocoding. And, what we did actually, we had a Skype with Nacho, which was really great. And her professional team explained how that's how it's done in the real world. And the kids really took to that. And then they started to work in groups sometimes around a table before they'd get on a computer and work out the pseudocode together. And I also began, somewhere around that time, to do the walkthroughs I mentioned yesterday. And part of the walkthroughs would also be to make sure everybody together we develop the pseudocode at times, you know, depending on the difficulty of the problem set. So it's an important part of it, and I think the kids have begun to appreciate the importance of it this year.
And in office hours, too, we all commonly encourage students, even though they have their laptop right there and they're working on the PSET, to actually take out a piece of paper and not so much do flow charts and the like, but like, actually, let's come a little closer together just for the camera's sake. Not so much do the more traditional flow charts, but just like draw boxes of memory, which actually maps very nicely to C, so that with each step through your program, you actually cross out what value is in some variable, and then repeat. And in fact, we didn't show it, we haven't shown it in much detail in this group, but the IDE that you saw last night, some of you, has a built-in debugger, quite like you would see in Eclipse or in NetBeans or Visual Studio or other tools, that even though it's a little more arcane, it will allow students to step through visually in a way that's much more accessible than like the command line GDB program, if you're familiar with that. So that too can help along these lines.
I think another thing that can help is when you take CS50 yourself through edX, you are going to, for your own success, you're going to need to pseudocode and you're going to need to sketch everything out. And Zamyla even says that. You know, she says, pseudocode everything, draw everything. So I can say, having taken the course, that I have two notebooks full of drawings, I have index cards, all of these things. So you know what? Take pictures of your work and then showcase your work with your students, and then that they will do what you do.
I think the other important thing is that pseudocode is not a language itself. It's not an exact science, and there are lots of different ways to pseudocode, and it's not just the what we saw lined up there. I think that it is things like flowcharts, it is things like even discussions or diagrams or drawings. There's many different ways in which one can pseudocode, and there's not one right way to do it. I think that letting students explore what makes them the most comfortable is the right entry point.
And invariably, that's the kind of code that's going to be on the exam, as you might have glimpsed in the purple packet, yeah. Some generic pseudocode.
That format we think is set.
Probably not safe to assume that just yet until the summer. But
that might be one thing to use that as your pseudocoding format so the kids.
Yeah, it's set enough that it will start to appear in the modules now that there is a more standard pseudocode language for the CS Principles exam. There will be examples that map that to C to Scratch.
I think ultimately showing students different formats, whether it's even if you don't use Scratch, showing them some Scratch blocks or showing them the more textual format there, the left arrow instead of an equal sign, just so that they don't get tripped up by the clutter. So one of the questions that we got asked here, as well as actually that came up last night, are you asking too much for students? And this came up in our circular discussion just yesterday. So the course has indeed been positioned as we intend the more rigorous of the AP-CSP offerings. As to whether it's too much, I think it's really a function of time. Most high school classrooms have the luxury of, or the benefit of, or the challenge of some 30 plus weeks. But I know in some cases there's shorter time frames, whether it's 18 weeks or fewer. And so I can say we go through the course's curriculum in just 13 or so weeks here, which is absolutely ambitious and tough, especially for working adults who are taking it through Harvard's Extension School. And so I think the best ingredient is that ability to stretch things out over time and to use 2 weeks or 1.5 for every one of our 1 weeks or 3 weeks. And in fact, we're nearing the point, I think, in the course here at Harvard, where it is actually a better educational experience to be taking this course online or a bit more asynchronously so that you're not constrained to the sort of traditional college schedule of classes on Monday through Friday or Monday and Wednesday in our case, and then a piece at due every single week. I think being able to play with the schedule is the key ingredient to success. So I dare say high schools are better positioned than we might be with this more confined schedule to tackle the course's material. So we shall see. Other questions. How does the grading workflow work? So we will see that right after this session in some detail with Doug and hands-on. And in fact, in the pipeline, you'll likely soon hear from us electronically, we're considering a number of new tools that we'll be making available not only to our own teaching staff here on campus, but to any teachers who might like to use it for collecting work, for grading work, as we said yesterday, for automating some detection of academic dishonesty, if that's of interest and such. Let's see, what can we? So let me toss that question back to folks in the room. What can we provide to you in terms of other materials and tools, whether it's curricular content, whether it's technological content? How can we be helpful if thoughts come to mind? Or what problems do you feel you might otherwise leave here not having solved?
I mean, I have an idea, if it's
sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I would love is more ideas, like more snippets of code.
Okay.
More, I think the kids really enjoy looking at code, and they learn a lot from looking at code. And early on when we started the curriculum, there were, you know, some very simple Hello World and Fahrenheit and fairly straightforward problems, but there weren't a lot of examples mm-hmm. of code for them to look at. And, you know, I used many of the examples from your video, but I felt that I started to create a few of my own, and being busy creating the curriculum, whatever, it was always a bit of a struggle to come up with something that was meaningful and
sure.
made sense and demonstrated integer overflow or floating point imprecision. And so, I just think more examples of code
okay.
are really, really helpful. So.
That's good timing, because one of the new features that will come out in the IDE in the next few weeks is the ability to provide students with a hyperlink that will directly open a file that you or we provide in the IDE so that they can immediately save it and start compiling mm-hmm. and playing. So we'll do more of that, for sure.
So
okay.
One of the things that I've not been able to find, which might be out there, are some smaller exercises that don't lead to code, but just towards asking them to come up with an algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Just to suit a whole series of, you know, they could have five of these for homework, not that they're mm-hmm. two tasks, but just practice.
Okay. Good, that's helpful. Okay, helpful. Christian?
In line with the code examples, maybe it would be useful to have examples on how code applies to applications that kids use daily.
Okay.
So for example, you know, I don't know, Instagram or Snapchat or WhatsApp, whatever is popular, and then break it down as if put a filter, anything, then the picture will look like this. If I do that, then anything, you can go to pseudocode, you can do it very simple, but that sort of looks like, oh, it applies to what I do all day, or it applies to what I do daily. So
it really comes organically with the pieces, like in pieces 4, when we're talking about images. Yeah, 5, that's something like whenever you're texting and you've got that underline, it's like, how did it know that it's underlined? And that's exactly what we say in the lecture. So we get the attention of the students, like, this is how we do it. How fast is, like, this underline was instant. How did it do that? So now, like,
and the later P sets, they're all applicable, all linked to a daily things that they're having. That's something that's beautiful.
Some more Snapchat. Yeah. I can imagine transmitting the videos that way, so they expire 7 seconds after they watch them. So you gotta focus. Yeah.
I like the idea of the samples code, but it would be nice to have, this is a sample code, this is what the pseudo code looks like, the plot is code.
Okay.
You know, that way they can say, oh, that's what the pseudo code, you know, they can compare.
Okay. That's helpful.
Or maybe like, sorry to jump in, but maybe like if we could do like diagrams to pseudocode to code, like that process I think is something that my students at least really struggle with, because they're like, they think code first and then they like try to translate into pseudocode to like meet my requirements, when really I want them to learn the thought process. From, it's weird in my brain, eventually narrowing.
Good, that's helpful. We'll see what we can do, especially even within the environment, to toggle between those kinds of views. Other requests, yeah.
Same line of thinking about the sample code. If you could do it in a way where it's indexed, like, you know, like with just small examples, like for example, you know, working with letters and
loops.
Like just have like loops, several bunch of different examples and what they do, rather than like 5 pages of one program.
Okay.
Because it, like, I know in my own experience, I'm working on the CS50 class right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll spend like an hour looking through like 5 books and videos, just trying to find like the example that I need. You know what I mean? And if there was just like one place that was just like a dictionary of,
so just for the code examples, you're saying
organized by category. You know,
okay.
Like working with floats and just had like, you know, maybe 2 or 3 lines of code and what they do.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because it's just hard to, it's so time consuming to find exactly what you're looking for.
And do you imagine you would present these, or you would have students work on them, a la worksheets in class, or?
Well, I mean, something for them to refer to, like a reference almost. Yeah. So if, or even like with the problem sets, if there was like a little packet of, you know, 3 pages of sample code, and not exactly what's in there,
sure,
in their problem that they're working on, but similar things, so they can kind of pull from it.
Okay, that's helpful.
Are you familiar with Study 50?
I did look at that.
There's some stuff there, but
do you think like more examples on in that order or in that way that it's categorized will help?
Yeah, almost like a reference code for each problem set. Smaller snippets, not like where you have to like open up a file and read this whole program, and then open up another file and read this whole program. So it was all in one place.
I think it'd be great to have things like that that go with the problem sets. And I know sometimes I've spent a lot of time coming up with an example, maybe for a warm-up, to, you know, print out 9 numbers in like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 to get them ready for 15, you know, so that they can think about how to use nested loops. And they'll do it together as a group as a warm-up, but the activity will kind of lead them into how to think about the actual problem set. So when they look at the problem, it's not so foreign to them. It's not the first time they've thought about how do I use nested loops to create this kind of an image, you know. So those would be fabulous, things like that. Because it is time consuming, you know, to find and to look for the right thing and something that makes sense, and it's not such
it's
a
not really
stretch that's not,
you know, first I'll look in, you know, Beginner's Guide to C, and then I look in this other book, and then I'm looking at the videos and trying to scan through the videos.
I identify exactly,
exact code is, and then look at like a search thing. You know what I mean? So it's just so many places to try to dig out the exact kind of thing that I'm looking for.
Agreed. And this isn't a wheel worth reinventing by everyone, so we'll see if we can factor that out for everyone. Yeah?
I just wanted to reiterate something Doug said a little bit ago, when I think we have to be really careful to and not turn pseudocode into just another language. Like, I don't think we're serving our students if we make pseudocode feel like it has to be something very specific. Because like Doug said, all the brains and all the minds in your classroom actually see that intermediate step differently. And the more we force them into a square hole, then the pseudocode becomes no different than the C code, I think, to them. So I think it's important to emphasize that we don't want to roboticize that pseudocoding part, because I have students who represent that intermediate thought process differently. And if I made them feel like they had to represent it according to the back of that booklet, then we're just, I see that as another roadblock.
Well, maybe the solution is to provide not just an example of pseudocode, but different types of examples of pseudocode, among which probably should be this canonicalized pseudocode, but also...
It was a couple questions ago.
But also diagrams or pseudocode just with different levels of precision in it.
It's truly how they see the problem and however they can...
Right, and even just being able to enumerate it two or three different ways just to get that spark generated.
Out, even two totally different approaches, the same type of pseudocode, two totally different approaches to solve the problem, maybe nested loops and something else, to both come up with the same answer.
I could see that even for our phone book example yesterday, where I used go to effectively instead of a for or a while concept.
Yeah, but to have it laid out, to drive the point home, there's not necessarily, there may be a correct answer, but there's many paths.
Okay. And I love the idea also of flowcharts, just for visual learners, because some schools, some students really will see things in a different way, right? So having a different way to envision it, I think, is great.
Okay, that's helpful. Okay. Well, one question here is, what kinds of final projects have been presented by students in the past? This is always like the hardest question, because we see like 600 plus projects at the end of the semester, and I always claim when asked, I love them all equally. but the most fun for me are the ones that really jump out, or the ones that integrate something that had not at all been introduced in the class. We had a student who brought his electronic piano or keyboard to the CS50 fair a few years ago and tied it in with a USB cable to his computer and actually synthesized music. We had a student who used one of these relatively inexpensive devices, the Leap Motion devices, that essentially detects hand movements like the Xbox Kinect, and connected that to his computer, and you could throw balls at the screen by moving your hand like this over his keyboard, which was really quite neat. There's so many projects on campus here, at least, that solve campus-themed projects for like navigating the course catalog or reviews thereof of the courses, for ordering food from like the house dining halls here, catching shuttle buses and such on campus. And in fact, in the absence of sort of a more creative or individualized project, we would encourage students to just look for problems around themselves, whether it's something mom and dad need, or some student group that they're involved in, or helping out their favorite teacher solve some problem, or signing up for like the sports events in the evenings or something like that. That at least sort of, that's what we do very early on in the semester, and encourage students to just keep an eye out for a problem that you think technology could solve. And that's been cool when then students really own that.
Find something that bugs them about the way things work in their school or at home, or and try and solve that problem computationally. Another cool example that I recall from not too long ago was a student who was a chef, or really liked to cook, and he was having trouble getting this particular type of mushroom from his grocery store, and so he purchased whatever you use to grow mushrooms, and built this device and had an Arduino connected to it such that it would regulate temperature and humidity, and it would when it detected that it was necessary to increase the humidity, it would close a vent. It was like Kinex, like Lego, or like a Kinex kit, just to slide the vent. And so that's something you wouldn't even expect. It doesn't even end up being a website. It's a box, it's a physical device, and it's just running and just checking and spraying mist into the box when it requires moisture. It's
And I'm a little biased. A project I remember I did once after learning programming was I really wanted to go see The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and they had a website that was just, you had to visit every day and be like the first person to wake up to click on the site. So I just wrote a program that essentially hit the site every day, probably for an hour, every hour or so, trying to find tickets. And sadly, I never got tickets anyway. I wasn't fast enough. But things like that, where students might recognize, wow, if I could automate that, just look what I could accomplish. Is compelling. So we see such a range. And do invite us, if you would, to your CS50 fairs. We'd love to attend virtually or in person. Let's see, this is...
Before you...
Yeah.
Is there a place where we could show some of those final projects to the students?
Short answer, yes. What we've done, we don't have soon. We have been for the past 2+ years collecting not only student source code as part of the final project submission, but we asked them to make a 2-minute video of them presenting it, either using screen capture or have a friend like film them on their iPhone or whatnot. And so what we have is a couple thousand videos of students' final projects. And so we need to go through and curate them, but we'll likely do exactly that to entice students to consider quite a range of opportunities.
Yeah, I'd love to show that on like the first day of class.
Yeah,
yeah.
We'll start to pull that together.
We do that actually in the info session before actually class starts. So they have an idea about what they're about to do. And our projects really vary from like what David was talking about. We used to have a student who built a castle that's all automated that is web integrated as well with video and sensors and everything. And it turned out when he finished, he actually started working in a company that did the same thing, but that castle was a cat house. And it was automated, and it was beautiful. It turned out from like an interest of a small project to have like a game into a real job later on. But on the other side of spectrum, like PSET 7 and PSET 8 are a great skeleton for building or solving many, many, many problems that students have. Whether as chatting yesterday with Casey about a project that I've seen here in Cambridge last time, for example, a girl was about to get married and she planned her entire wedding for their families going out from one state to another. It was like scheduling system, authentication, putting all the photos and all the things in one place. So the thing that we've seen at great projects is where the problem or interest that they have and they work from there. So that's what we encourage. Like, if you see something that's there, think of how can you use, for example, PSET 7 and 8 to do it. And that's like, that's not the first thing that we say, but like later on, like after a week when we give the project guidelines.
Other questions from the crowd? Ramon.
We also have the fair videos.
Yeah. That's true. We have a lot of
interviews.
So, yeah, the production team films students presenting their actual projects in the context of a lot of music and balloons and other students. So we have a few of those, one of which we showed yesterday for the high school hackathon that we did. So we have similar ones from the fairs. Yeah?
Margaret, I was hoping you could speak too. I've been piloting this course for 2 years, and so I've had students be doing the performance task. And your Arduino story is wonderful, but it's a little, you know, it's hard to get those kinds of examples coming out of the high school classroom. You know, structurally, they recommend 15 hours of class time to build this. And what I've found is that the students can be paralyzed at first because they really feel pressured to solve this incredibly cool problem. And sometimes coming up with that is the hard part. And in reality, you know, the apps take a lot of time. If they're really genuine in terms of solving an intense problem. And the key to that is to make it really interesting to them so then they go and work on a lot on their own, and that works well sometimes. But you do still end up with a fair amount of mole mashes and soundboards, right? So can you talk about your projects at the high school level and like how you have promoted and increased the level of those?
Well, to be honest, we're just getting started right now.
Okay.
So. One of the reasons we started on the web unit 2 weeks ago was because I feel like a lot of the students are, you know, obviously they're very familiar with the internet and their phones and all this, and so to be able to create a project that works in their web browser is very attractive to a lot of them. So I'm having them think about it right now. They're going to submit pre-proposals next week, and I'll let you know when it happens, but we haven't quite gotten there yet.
One question here is, how much effort do you spend grading quiz questions, which are mainly not multiple choices? In the fall semester, we have two quizzes, or which is an understatement for exams, about midway through the semester and toward the end of the semester, but before the final project. I have moved away, actually, from doing multiple choice style questions on those over time, mostly because even though they're harder for us to grade, I've preferred the free form, where we're really trying to assess qualitatively how much students have mastered the art of thinking through problems and solving them. And so we spent, to grade 800 exams, we spend 5 to 7 hours with 60 people in the room to churn through them. But we spend maybe 2 minutes per page, and all 9 years of CS50's quizzes are available on the course's website, and you can look back through those and sample solutions. And we'll start to excerpt those so that they're more accessible than in these more monolithic documents. But we would spend about 2 minutes per page. Each exam has maybe 10 pages, so there's 20 minutes per exam, but spread around multiple people. And one of the tools we alluded to yesterday and might come up again in this morning's grading session is we've been working with some third parties to provide more efficient grading workflows for things like quizzes and things like code, so more to come in the next few months.
And among our longer term goals that we've had at CS50 more generally, as well as now with the AP initiative, is to curate those questions into a topically organized form so that they can easily be drawn from as a question bank. That you could then incorporate into larger quizzes or tests or pop quizzes or more regular assessments like that. So,
yeah, I have to
put that up. But that's a tool we've been working on or thinking about how best to implement for a little while now.
I do steal a lot of the questions from your past quizzes, from my quizzes, and I love them. I just think they're fun. You know, they have little subheads. You know, that just kind of keeps it a little bit playful.
Yeah.
And sometimes a little visual. You know.
Sometimes a few cats.
Yeah. So. And then having the answers available also is just very helpful for grading. So I have a pretty good idea of what I'm looking for when I'm grading. So it's not terrible. But
one question here is there a place for CS50 AP teachers to share resources and share conversation? Absolutely. So there's one tool called CS50 Discuss, which is a community not only of present but also past teachers who've been partaking. There's the CS50 Wiki, which will evolve into another tool that teachers have been suggesting things for over time, and we'll likely roll out other such tools, whether it's Slack or Facebook group just for teachers and so forth. So we'll keep people apprised of that.
And the Discuss forum contains an archive of all the questions that we've already, all the threads that have been running, so that there might be a question that was asked last year and maybe is relevant to you, and so it's searchable, and hopefully that'll be helpful as well.
Will they get invitations to Discuss?
They will. It requires an edX login, and in the update that you'll get tomorrow, it'll have information about how to access that community and introduce yourself, et cetera.
I signed up for the CS50. Signed up for HTML, not knowing how much credit I'm going to get as a teacher.
Okay.
You know, saying teachers need to get PDPs or mm-hmm. CUs. Nacho just said it might be up to 90 for the CS50.
To clarify, well, it's 90 hours of work, but I don't know how that translates.
Yeah,
the CEUs are different for every district.
If the courses could actually say that, this could be worth, I think you'd see a lot more teachers saying, oh, wow, I can get that many PDPs for taking this class. I think it's going to attract a lot more.
Okay, that's helpful.
Especially in the content area, mm-hmm. you know, it's like you have to get 150 total PDPs, and they're broken down for your license to maintain your licensure. It's in Massachusetts, I'm sure it's the same around. But
okay.
It would be great to know how much it's worth to them.
Connecticut dropped them.
You don't have to get them? No?
Drop the whole thing.
Okay. That's helpful, though. We'll do as much as we can for each state for along those lines. Other questions? Yeah, Christian.
For students that don't have a computer at home, mm-hmm. but maybe have a smartphone, what tools do you recommend, if any, for them to practice at home or maybe review some material? I know I personally use a Kindle sometimes on my phone because you have a lot of free time and the bus or wherever, but are there any other tools outside of a computer that we could recommend to people
I mean, the course is accessible, I think well accessible by phone in terms of the static content, things like videos and such. All of the textual documents will automatically reformat for mobile. The IDE is, I would say, barely usable, or any IDE is probably barely usable on such little screen real estate. We have certainly seen students do it, and we see screenshots popping up, as I've mentioned to a few folks on Facebook, of students posting code that they're working on, and I don't envy that particular workflow. So anything larger, really, whether it's an iPad or Surface or Android tablet or the like, should work. Everything except Scratch right now is HTML5 based, so should just work well. So really anything with a slightly larger screen I think is compelling for at least the hands-on part. But with the CSOD IDE, even if they don't have something at home, certainly anywhere in school, at a friend's computer, in a computer lab, in a library, cafe, at least they can access their private account. Yeah, other questions? Yeah?
A couple of things that came up, they're not really questions, but they were just kind of interesting things that came up, and I don't know if everybody heard them, just in different discussions. Mm-hmm. One was if schools have internships, maybe, you know, if a student took CS50 as a junior in high school, they could be like an aide.
That's a great idea.
Oh. As a senior.
Nice.
That's a great idea.
You know, because that way you could, you know, if there's some really great students, they could help support the kids in the class.
Yeah,
I think it's a wonderful idea.
And also get credit for it and the experience. Because, you know, it seems like, you know, the bigger it gets or whatever, you have all these, like, people helping and stuff, and that might be a really good...
That's an interesting contribution to try to make, especially given our precedent of having undergraduate teaching fellows do exactly that.
Right.
What do you think a typical school or principal or headmaster would need to know or be told or see in order to be comfortable considering giving those students credits, for
Somebody
instance?
Here has that system.
Well, we have, the other technical high school would too. Our students at the end of their junior year and their senior year can go out on co-op and intern.
Okay.
And I mean,
we have it in our school too.
Yeah, it's a genius. I could, as a shop instructor, determine that I could have a student do an internship. I'd have to go through some formality and have a job description and define the parameters of what they would do. But in most technical high schools, I think that infrastructure is there.
Okay, that's
not
helpful.
Just technical either. I mean, I'm a regular high school, and we have internships. So right now, there's not a lot. I'm kind of surprised there's not a lot of teachers' aides. They go and aid at like the elementary school.
Okay.
And help with like gym classes and stuff, but.
Maybe call it teaching fellows, right? I was a teaching fellow.
Make it like a cool thing.
I like this. I'll see if we can add this to the sort of the messaging of the course to make it all the more of interest to students and teachers.
We have independent studies.
Okay.
I think it would fit as well. Not internships, but an independent study.
And it would still count for credit.
That would still count for credit.
Would there typically be an expectation by the school that you need to write an essay at the end of the experience or anything we would facilitate?
Yeah.
Or? Like ours is a weekly work log.
They get like evaluated.
Hours.
Okay.
Yeah, we could certainly create some. For us, it's very teacher.
Okay. Let me just make a note to myself here.
I think the department chair.
And there's.
Since we're on the topic.
Yeah.
Spend so much time with the high school internship at Microsoft, there is a decent amount of internships targeted at students of this age range, where if you have a student that's a TF or a really amazing CS50 student, there's some really exciting opportunities out there, and I think that might be something that would be interesting to surface for you guys as educators, because if you were to send Microsoft a, hey, look at my amazing student email, that's a really strong applicant for us.
Okay, so are we doing that? I know we do it in Redmond. Are we doing it at other Microsoft offices now?
There's only one here in Boston.
Okay.
It used to be called Foundry. They just changed the name of it.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's a really cool program, and those guys are amazing. There's also, well beyond Microsoft, and as I'm sure you guys know, there's lots of startups in the area. So that might be an interesting resource to start. I'm not super familiar with the Cambridge area, but I know there's a lot.
Can you post the former Foundry one, that information in discuss?
There's at least one other question here. What actually happens at a hackathon? What are some of the programming challenges? It is really dependent. We typically focus here at the college on final projects toward the tail end of the semester. But at Miami-Dade, at Browning in New York, and a few other venues, we have focused more on problem sets wherever students are, especially if they are allowed to be out of sync with their fellow classmates. This way, as I think Nacho mentioned yesterday, at the high school, for instance, we had this is table for kids working on Mario. This is the table for Game of 15. This is the table for such and such. Really just to facilitate peer support of each other. And I think what's really key isn't so much what the students are working on per se, but just the atmosphere that you create and the fact that people want to be there. They're not just doing it because they have to and because there's some other pull to it, whether it is candy or music or lunchtime or whatnot. And I think the more visible you can make these kinds of events, the better within a school.
Yeah, just a comment on that. I want to say my students came away so energized from it. And I had a number of students actually during parent conferences just this week that said after the hackathon, my daughter said she wants to go into computer science, things along those lines, which was really cool. So they just had an amazing time. And it just kind of made this additional positivity, you know, to the whole idea of computer science and CS50. So it's a whole cultural aspect, which is great. They're already asking if they could have another hackathon this year. So.
What is the right moment to make the hackathon? At the middle of the course, at the end of the course, at the beginning?
I think both. Not so much the beginning, I would say. I would say Puzzle Day is what's meant to be at the beginning because it assumes no programming experience and involves no programming. Middle has worked well, I think, not only for just fun and excitement, but re-engagement, as Sadi spoke to yesterday. Students who might be kind of disengaging and wanting something or being receptive to something pulling them back in. And at the end is a sort of strategically optimal because it's final projects and everyone by design then is doing something on their own. So you don't necessarily have students working on the same challenges. So it's all the more of a supportive atmosphere, hopefully. But both work well, I think.
And even the hackathon, like even for our students, in any case, whether you're working more on your piece or your final project, still gave students are more confident in themselves because, oh, so this is like a hackathon. And we hear about these hackathons that companies do and they go around. It's like they are more confident in themselves to go to the real world with their knowledge. That is something that we got. Starting with Arturo, you want to add something?
Yeah. That was definitely something that opened me up to the world of hackathons, and I try to make it up to everyone that I can after that. So that's something I would agree with.
The subject of hackathons leads to another great question we have in here, which is, do students really end up helping one another? Harvard definitely can have a reputation sometimes as being a competitive place. It was a competitive place when I was here. But I think that part of what has made CS50 unique is that it does have this cultural aspect where that is not so much a factor anymore. Students really do help one another. As soon as, you know, in office hours, you'll see students get together, and as soon as one of them gets it, it's, well, have you tried doing this? They immediately start to take on a sort of a surrogate teaching fellow role, trying to help their peers get across the finish line as well. It's very much a team, an individual but team effort. To get everybody to the end of this experience that is intensive and rigorous and can be trying sometimes, but they want as many people to get across the finish line, and we want as many people to get across the finish line, and we really do see a lot of it, and it's really remarkable and inspiring to see in small group sections and office hours. It really does happen.
And in terms of collaboration and academic honesty, the heuristic to which Doug alluded yesterday has worked well, I think, whereby if Doug is in front of his laptop struggling with something, we encourage students like Doug, ask David to look over at your screen and help you with whatever you're struggling with. But what the line they should not cross is Doug should not solve his problem by looking at my screen. And as he disclaims, you can kind of game that system logically, but the spirit of it is exactly that. Someone else can look at your screen to help you, and that seems to work well.
But can they type in your screen?
We have no such restrictions on that, but
my kids, when they go to help somebody, they say, "Here, let me do that." Yeah, now you know how to do it.
That's why, in our case, we don't tell them like, don't do it on the computer. Do it on a piece of paper. Help them on a piece of paper, but don't help them on the keyboard. There's one more thing that I ask them not to do, and I know they sometimes do it, but like I ask them not to do is that. So don't start helping somebody unless you're done with your piece head, because once, like, I don't want you to see part that you didn't figure out on his screen and a part that you figured out, because once you saw it, you can't take it off from your head. So it's like, I just explain it, why you're asking them to do that in a way, and they will listen. So not just don't, I more explain why, and they kind of appreciate it later on.
And I just wanted to add, like with the expert system, as we call it in my classroom, you know, when the kid finishes, one of the students finishes their problem set, they often will ask to be an expert. They feel proud and excited to be able to share that expertise. And so that kind of gets around the academic honesty problem as well, because they've already finished. So now they're going able to go around and kind of help other students debug their code. And then the other thing is, when I love when they get around a table together and work out the pseudocode together. And so that happens at times as well. So that's a nice way of working collaboratively, but yet maintaining that academic honesty. So that's worked well.
And Jack, to get to your question, you go back to that again, your comment. I think that when all else fails, I would encourage a hands-off approach, because not only can it be counterproductive if the student is typing for somebody else, but also just the act of the student serving in the teacher role explaining the concept also reinforces it. It's a two-way benefit. Right, it reinforces the concept for the student doing the explaining, and also perhaps provides an alternative perspective for the student who is on the receiving end of that assistance. And so I would, and generally in office hours when I'm working with students, I keep a very hands-off approach unless it's absolutely necessary. I try not to touch anybody's keyboards, and just encourage a dialogue back and forth.
So the last question before us is, how does the grading workflow work? Which is a perfect segue to a 15-minute break, after which point we'll resume here and actually do some hands-on tinkering. Yeah.
I have one more question. Could you briefly touch on the difference between office hours and sections?
Sure. Office hours are meant to be one-on-one opportunities for help. We'd gather students in most any room, and we bring a whole bunch of the course's staff there. And when a student has a question, he or she summons us over, catches our eye, and we would go down, lean next to their station, and just answer questions that they might have. The overarching goal being to unblock them.
So they're coming to work, and people just walking around.
Correct. It's an environment to work on your PSETs, and if and when you have questions, we'll come over and do our best to efficiently unblock you. And in our case, what's commonly the case is students, Zamyla makes more appearances at office hours virtually than anywhere else, and you see just a sea of her face sometimes as students work their way through the problem sets. And the notion of a walkthrough we mentioned upstairs last night, in addition to Zamyla's embedded walkthroughs pre-shot on video, will often, especially if we're overwhelmed, if the teacher-student ratio isn't so great in an office hour setting, we'll factor out as many students as we can. Hey, anyone struggling with Mario.c, come over here, and then we'll have one person at a whiteboard sort of reiterating what Zamyla is doing, but offering a slightly different perspective that hopefully resonates more, and that helps siphon off some of the load. Sections, meanwhile, are more traditional classes, whereby our lectures are people like me talking to with many students all at once. Sections are meant to be a 1-to-15 teacher-student ratio. So Doug and other members of the staff will commonly lead those smaller scale classes that are much more akin to a medium-sized or small-sized high school classroom to reiterate some of the week's material, to go into additional examples, to answer questions, and really create an environment that students are more comfortable.
And those are planned out ahead of time? You would go into a section with an agenda?
Yes.
Exactly.
Frequently gets deviated from, but I have a plan that I start with. I'm sure that's an all-too-familiar experience.
Required?
Nothing in CS50 is required, per se. You're expected, but not required. Once a week for 90 minutes, and lectures are twice a week for 60 minutes. 4 times a week for 180 minutes, but purely optional.
And I've also gotten some good teaching ideas from the section videos. Mm. You know, just because it is kind of a classroom setting, which is a little bit more of a kind of a traditional type of lesson that way. So sometimes just examples or ways of presenting things, it's been helpful to watch those and use those as well.
And to be clear, the videos have been evolving. What we call sections are just what I described. What we call this year section videos are just Doug on camera against a white backdrop, playing the role of a proxy for that environment, so that the focus is entirely on the online students. So when you see Doug's section, you won't see anyone else, even though in reality there are typically many students in the room.
I just have one more comment.
Sure.
I don't know how feasible it would be or whatever, but maybe Microsoft and Harvard could sponsor some sort of like CS50, you know, event for high school students to take a field trip for the ones that are accessible to, you know, Harvard and Cambridge. And that would kind of, you know, enforce the whole sort of prestige of Harvard and maybe get them excited about it. And I don't know, they could hack
hackathon.
Yeah, like a hackathon at the beginning of the year, or some a puzzle day or whatever. Get a tour of campus and show, you know, kind of like what we had, you know. And I think that would get them to feel like invested and sort of like this special
absolutely
thing.
So you're already cordially invited to the 9th annual CS50 fair this coming December. We'll send out the dates for that. We haven't done it with Puzzle Day before, but I like this idea, so we'll probably extend an invitation to Puzzle Day at the start of the semester. The hackathon, at least in our case we probably wouldn't, since it's an overnight thing, and so that opens a can of worms on our end, but the fair and Puzzle Day I think we probably would.
Some of our pilot educators brought their students to the Yale Fair.
Yes, we can meet you in New Haven or Cambridge now for that, and wherever else things spring up.
The idea of a high school one.
Yeah, just for the high school students.
I see.
So many.
If you could, provide a
venue. Absolutely.
Just show of hands, how many folks in here are within easy driving distance?
Oh, that's great.
Boston Metro, so there's a critical mass.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll see what we can do, much like we did in New York a few weeks back. Helpful. All right, shall we take our break here and then return for
grading? Yes, we'll
resume
at 10:30 for a session on how we do grading and assessment in CS50.
Excellent.
Thank you.